This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
I'm Deborah Bell.
I'm J.D. Doyle.
And somewhere, we have a stealth person who's running the board. So what's our topic tonight?
Our topic tonight is...
Did we run out of topics?
Jack Belinsky. This Thursday, there's a special fundraising event with the Houston Equal Rights Alliance, and it's honoring 25 years of activism in Houston by Mr. Jack Belinsky. So we're going to tell
all...
He's
only 31.
It's pretty amazing.
And twice so over.
Tammy Wallace and Brian Boyle from HERA will join us, and we're just going to find out everything there is to know about Jack Belinsky. And then we will be having our usual announcements, commentary, and good stuff like that. And then what do you have on tap for Queer Music Heritage?
The second hour is Queer Music Heritage, and two really neat interviews. One with the founder of the woman's rock band Lilith. And Deborah remembers Lilith.
Yes, I do.
And also in the second part of that is rising artist Levi Christ. I interviewed him last year. It was a great interview, and now we're going to bring him up to date with it because he has a new album.
That sounds fabulous. Today is the 30th anniversary of the first meeting at the White House with the GLBT activists. And NGLTF, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, had a conference call. And many of the people that participated in that meeting were on the conference call. And I only caught the last part of it because I was running around from post office to post office.
Do you remember some of the names?
Well, some of the names would be Troy Perry.
That's pretty good.
And Pokey Anderson.
Oh, wow. KPFT's very own.
Yes, our very own Pokey Anderson. And actually, Pokey played a pretty significant role in that conference call talking about the time. The president wasn't actually there when they had the meeting, but they talked to some of the very close advisors who then talked to the president.
Who was the president?
It was Jimmy Carter. And he was at Camp David working on some peace issues.
And it wasn't until 1992 that there was actual a meeting with a sitting president, which was President Clinton.
Is there a pattern here?
GLBT.
Is there a pattern here in these presidents?
Can you spell Democratic president?
Yeah.
So, and it was interesting because some of the talk was about how far we've come, and some of the talk was we still got a lot further to go. And Pokey sort of ended the call, and I'm not going to be able to actually quote some of the stuff, but basically one of the people said, you know, we've come a long way, but in the regards to the rest of the modern world, we haven't. And there are some, as Pokey talked about, they asked what some of the people are doing now. And, of course, Pokey did a lot of work here at KPFT in the news department, in the Enron story. But some of the other things that, you know, things like health care, which is a very important thing, not only to the GLBT community, but to the general community at large. So, you know, congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
When was this interview, and is it captured somewhere that you could hear?
Well, very good question. Very good question.
I'm so glad you asked.
Thank you.
They said it would be available online at the NGLTF website, which I believe is thetaskforce.org. Interesting, you know, they have the Creating Change every year at the task force, but I don't think they have the city chosen for this year.
Really?
Yeah, which is sort of interesting.
I'm going to have to check that because it seems to me I saw it somewhere. But,
well, maybe,
you know.
Probably not Kingston, Jamaica.
Or
yeah,
Pasadena, Texas.
Yeah, there's probably lots of places it's not.
So that's a really interesting, it was really interesting. I wish I caught the whole thing, but...
You can try the website.
Well, let's do it right now. I have to turn my sound back on.
On your little laptop there, you can just turn it on, let people listen to it that way. We'll share it with everyone.
Well, you know, it's not too long ago at KPFT when we couldn't get the BBC, we'd put a little shortwave radio and put the microphone next to it. So, you know, we've come a long way here at KPFT.
Because the show must go on.
Yes.
That's the spirit.
And speaking of the show going on.
Well, let's go on then to news wrap from This Way Out.
A I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 24th, 2007. New lesbi-gay equality laws passed muster this week in Britain's House of Lords. Peers rejected a Tory amendment to throw out the Equality Act sexual orientation regulations by a vote of 168 to 122. The legislation bans discrimination based on sexual orientation in the provision of goods and services, just as existing measures ban racial and gender-based discrimination. The government's community secretary, Ruth Kelly, hailed the regulations to take effect in April as a major step forward that will deliver dignity, respect, and fairness for all. It cannot be right in a decent, tolerant society that a shopkeeper or restaurant can refuse to serve a customer just because they are gay. There were angry demonstrations outside the Lord's chambers protesting the legislation, and the Roman Catholic Bishop of Winchester and a Church of England bishop, who's also a member of the House of Lords, each claimed that the rights of lesbians and gay men were trumping everyone else's. But openly gay Labour peer Lord Ali noted that the sight of children holding up homophobic placards outside the Lord seems to be a good argument for these regulations. Catholic adoption agencies have been given 21 months to comply with the new laws. They've faced criticism for threatening to shut down if the regulations were approved. The 21-month window is said to give them sufficient time to pass on their skills and experience to secular agencies.
Bills expanding the definition of hate crimes and sex education were introduced this week in the U.S. Congress. A similar version of the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act passed in the House of Representatives last year, but died in the Senate, which is expected to get a companion bill in April. The legislation adds sexual orientation, gender, and gender identity to local hate crimes that the U.S. Justice Department has the authority to investigate. It makes grants available to state and local agencies for training law enforcement personnel and for investigating and prosecuting such crimes. The Federal Bureau of Investigation's anti-queer hate crime statistics are now based only on voluntary reporting, and some states and major cities don't even participate. Proponents are hoping that the hate convictions this week of four men in the brutal New York City bashing attack on openly gay performer Kevin Aviance and the highly reported beating death of 72-year-old gay man Andrew Anthos in Detroit last month will put a current spotlight on the issue and spur passage of the bill this time.
The second bill introduced in Congress this week would provide grants for comprehensive and age-appropriate sex education, replacing the abstinence-only, hetero-only limitations imposed under the former Republican leadership and current president. The federal government is expected to spend more than $1 billion in abstinence-only education through next year. Federal funding is denied to institutions that discuss homosexuality or birth control. The Responsible Education About Life Act was introduced in the House by California Democrat Barbara Lee and Connecticut Republican Christopher Shays, and in the Senate by New Jersey Democrat Frank Lautenberg. It would grant $206 million per year to states for comprehensive sexuality education. We need to get real about sex education, Lee said in a written statement. We should absolutely be teaching young people about abstinence, but we shouldn't be holding back information that can save lives and prevent unwanted pregnancies.
Full legal equality for gays and lesbians hasn't ended homophobia in Quebec, according to a report issued earlier this month by the Canadian province's Human and Youth Rights Commission. Based on the work of the government's Joint Task Force on Homophobia, it says that sexual minorities still encounter discrimination at work, at school, and within their families, as well as in healthcare, social services, and sports and leisure activities. The report also said that young gay males are 6 to 16 times more likely to think about or attempt suicide compared with their heterosexual peers, and that young lesbians are 5 times more likely to consider or attempt suicide. The commission recommended appointing a government minister to draft, fund, and implement a provincial strategy against homophobia. It said work is needed in the areas of information, awareness, training, scientific knowledge, and support for LGBT organizations. Quebec's Minister of Justice has vowed to implement the Commission's recommendations.
Both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch this week condemned a legislative proposal in Poland that would allow teachers to be fired for promoting what the bill calls homosexual culture. The bill is not clearly defined, but would seem to include a ban on teaching basic information about HIV/AIDS and lessons promoting tolerance towards gays and lesbians. It's the latest culture clash between Poland and international human rights organizations since a socially conservative government took office in late 2005, focusing its rhetoric on so-called family values and what it calls the need for a moral renewal. Polish authorities claim to be protecting families. Scott Long, director of Human Rights Watch's LGBT rights program, said in a statement, but in fact, they're trying to deny children free speech and life-saving information on HIV/AIDS. Schools should be training grounds for tolerance, not bastions of repression and discrimination. Michael Heflin, director of Amnesty International USA's OutFront program, said this proposed legislation is repugnant. It violates international human rights standards and goes against Poland's own constitution. The world must tell Polish authorities that this is completely unacceptable.
But in the Australian island state of Tasmania, the government is funding an anti-homophobia campaign intended for all its high schools, following recommendations issued by the University of Tasmania. Called Pride and Prejudice, the university's review urged the expansion of a pilot program that's been running in three local high schools. State Education Minister David Bartlett is pledging $50,000 to train about 15 additional teachers to run the course. Senior education lecturer Doug Bridge told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the course has made a difference in students' attitudes toward gay men and lesbians, saying that all of the students who were involved in the pilot program emerged with less homophobic attitudes.
U.S. Episcopal bishops risked losing communion with their global Anglican counterparts this week by resolutely affirming their support for gay and lesbian relationships. Anglican bishops meeting in Tanzania last month, prompted by theologically conservative leaders in its African, Asian, and Latin American regions, issued an ultimatum to the U.S. Church, which is part of the 77 million member Global Communion, giving it until September 30th to stop authorizing ceremonies for same-gender unions. The ultimatum also demanded an unequivocal pledge not to consecrate another partnered gay bishop, as the Episcopal Church did with the elevation of New Hampshire's Gene Robinson in 2003. In strong and direct language, the Episcopal House of Bishops said that it views the gospel as teaching full inclusion of lesbians and gay men in the church. The bishops also said they would oppose any plan for Anglican leaders outside the U.S. to oversee the small number of defecting conservative American Episcopal congregations, as was also proposed in Tanzania. If that means that others reject us and communion with us, as some have already done, the bishop's resolution stated, we must, with great regret and sorrow, accept their decision. The small but affluent Episcopal Church, with 2.3 million members, underwrites a significant chunk of the communion's budget. The Anglican spiritual leader, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams, issued a brief statement calling the Episcopal resolution discouraging. But the Reverend Susan Russell of the Episcopal queer advocacy group Integrity compared the bishop's statement to a coming out process, saying, this was a huge step that the American church was not willing to go back into the closet about its inclusion of gay and lesbian people in order to capitulate to those who would exclude us. North American Anglicans appear to be on a collision course with the rest of the communion. The Canadian Church's Council of General Synod approved a resolution last week saying that the blessing of same-sex unions is consistent with the core doctrine of the Anglican Church of Canada.
The Church of Sweden sent mixed messages this week about performing lesbi-gay wedding ceremonies if Parliament changes the current law to allow same-gender marriage. Even though it already blesses legal registered gay and lesbian partnerships, Archbishop Anders Weyrud said that the Church might refuse to carry out the ceremonies if a new law referred to the partnerships as marriage, and insisted that individual priests be allowed to refuse to conduct them. Registered partnerships have been legal in Sweden since 1995 and grant most of the benefits and obligations of marriage. However, a parliamentary committee concluded last August that the law was outdated and recommended that the government propose legislation to establish full marriage equality. Hans Reinier, formerly Sweden's most senior government lawyer, issued a report this week saying that same-gender couples should be able to marry and to be legally regarded as spouses.
And finally, the Associated Press reported this week that police officials in the Philippines are warning gay officers not to sway their hips or display other suggestive behavior while on duty, or risk losing their jobs. Chief Superintendent Samuel Pagdalao, a spokesman for the Philippine National Police, told a Manila radio station that his department doesn't discriminate, but would not hesitate to fire those who behave in a questionable manner. If gay officers sway their hips while marching, or if they engage in lustful conduct, I think that will be a ground for separation, he said. There have been no reports of any specific incidents that might have prompted Pagdalao's comments. A new political party in the Philippines specifically representing lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people was recently refused registration for May congressional elections on the grounds that it doesn't have nationwide chapters. Its members are appealing.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 24th, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Larry.
In the world, I don't believe one of these stories I've heard. Got pretty policemen in leather and jeans, showing their legs through a split in the seams, leering at people, leading them on, then running them in when they start to respond. The press all ignore it, they don't want to see, except when the case is a Tory MP. If you're happy that way, hey, sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. The pictures of naked young women are best in the news of the screws and the popular press. They plaster their pages with bingo and tits, then add all the scandal and slander that fits. The women of Greenham they smeared and despised. They crucify Elton with sneering and lies. If it's paedophile teachers and lesbian nuns, if it's filthy and fiction, it's all there in the sun. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. And now there's a cancer to blame on the gays. It's brutal and fatal and slowly invades. The moral majority like it a lot, cause it's the wages of sin and the judgment of God. The medics are baffled and caught on the run. They say it's a nightmare that's barely begun. And government spending is barely a joke, cause saving gay lives doesn't win any votes. So try and sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. All our books and treat us like lepers and sinners and crooks. Just hope you don't get caught up in the raids or pick up a pig or a partner with AIDS. Lie to your workmates and lie to your folks. Put down the clones and tell lesbian jokes. Forget the aggression from everywhere else while we still do a wonderful job oppressing ourselves. Say if you're happy that way. Hey! Say if you're glad to be gay. Say if you're happy that way. Hey! Say if you're glad to be gay. Say if
This is J.D., and that, of course, was Tom Robinson with his anthem, Glad to Be Gay. He originally did that in 1978, one of the first openly gay songs to make the charts, well, in England at least, and the version you just heard was redone in 1987. Jack?
This is Queer Voices.
Yeah, I remember finding the vinyl of that, Cabaret 79, in a cutout area of one of the local record stores, and I like played and played and played that. I'm so glad they released that on a CD because it's, you know, I mean, Tom Robinson was so much ahead of his time. And in fact, what's really strange is he's now married to a woman.
Yeah.
And he is a host on BBC Radio 6. And he has been... Basically, people know him for knowing the music, too. Not only producing it, but knowing it.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of your favorite songs.
Well, and one of my favorite artists. The fact that he was out then and talked about the issues that were going on back then. Yeah.
Well, and of course, one of the reasons we played it is because there's a very special event coming up this Thursday night. It's being put on by the Houston Equal Rights Alliance, HERA. Tammy Wallace is with us. What is your position with HERA?
President.
She's the president. Well, we wish she was the president, as in the White House, but... and what exactly does HERA do?
Well, we have three pieces to our mission, and that is community building, education, and advocacy, and particularly building alliances within not just the GLBT community, but the progressive community as a whole, and holding legislators accountable.
Very important. And very wisely, HERA... obtained the services of Jack Walensky to work for them as their director of operations, but also they recognize the fact that Jack has been around a while in the Houston community and has done a lot of really important things, so they thought that it would be a real good match to have an event that would raise funds for the organization and to recognize the achievements and contributions of Jack Walensky to the Houston GLBT community. You know, some movie stars started calling in, Jack, and
they
wanted to give their congratulations, and we kept having to tell them, no, it's Walensky, not Valenti.
Right.
So how did a young Polish boy from northeastern Pennsylvania manage to find his way down to Houston, Texas?
Well, like a lot of people, I had a very good opportunity for a job. ABC Radio, which owned a radio station called 97 Rock, had just changed formats, and they were looking for an assistant engineer. And I had moved in July of that year, of 1981, to New Orleans, going from a small station to what was that considered a major market, New Orleans, or a bigger market, a bigger area. And the station basically lied to me about what they were going to do. They had a News Talk AM, and they had an FM music station, and they really had no money to really compete in New Orleans. So after 3 months, I said, it's time to leave. And when I sent my resume to Houston, I never thought I'd get the job because I figured there'd be tons of people applying for that job. But because I had background in going through a hurricane in South Carolina, the chief engineer said he brought me in. And I was like the only person he interviewed, which was like, wow.
Isn't it amazing how those hurricanes cause people to make people's news careers? Isn't Dan Rather, isn't that what happened with him?
Yes. And so I moved here in November of 81, and it was the day Kathy Whitmire got elected, just coincidence.
And for many people who may not know, Kathy Whitmire was elected mayor of the city of Houston.
Right, which was like, you know, first progress, you know, really progressive person, a woman being supported by the gay community. And then I started listening to KPFT because I never really, I mean, I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, and we used to be able to receive WBAI in New York, but I didn't really quite grasp it back then or the beginnings of public radio. In fact, the junior college I went to in northeastern Pennsylvania, there was a NPR station just going on the air, and it was about 20 miles or from the college I went to, and I used to hitchhike every Monday back and forth just to volunteer. And I remember even before the station went on the air, they would play All Things Considered Closed Circuit, and it's like, wow, this is really neat, you know, that they could really do justice on some of the stories. And back then at NPR, it was mostly over the phone. They didn't really have what they have today. So when I moved to Houston, I started listening to KPFT, and one of the things, when I was listening to a show called Wildenstein, Ray Hill was the person who pretty much ran the show, like he runs many things, but he would be off mic a lot of times, and, you know, you wouldn't always hear the guest very well, and I thought, well, at least I can come over to KPFT if he was interested and volunteer and just run the board. And it sort of all started from there.
Yeah.
Downhill.
Well, sometimes we have a lot of those same difficulties with, you know, technical things.
Well,
we still have problems, but the quality of what we have equipment-wise certainly is.
Well, and actually our
move up.
A lot of the equipment we have here is past its age of you know, working, but Steve Brightwell, who's the engineer here, and luckily Glenn,
when
who runs
here.
The equipment, does an incredible job of making us all sound good.
Well, that's a good thing. We need all the help that we can get. So your background as far as your work life was in radio engineering.
Right.
Had you always been drawn to that?
I have always been drawn to either radio or television. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And actually, when I was growing up, we were one of the first areas to have home box office. And they, you know, back then when they'd run a movie, they ran it over and over again. And one of the movies I saw was A Day for Life. It was a French movie about making a movie. And I thought what was really interesting is how all these people came from different parts and worked together, you know, for a finite time, you know.
What a
it's
concept.
Sort of like watching Carol Burnett or something, you know, we need to raise money, so let's put on a variety show. And I thought that was really neat because in New Orleans, the station I worked for was the one that did the New Orleans Saints. And there was sort of that concept there. Well, as you get involved in stuff here in the community, we do that. We all sort of get together and, you know, have our sort of arguments as a family sometimes. But then we do something. We put on Pride Parade or we help get people elected or, you know.
Or we do
like
a radio show.
Right, or we do a radio show. And the fact that over the years, the theme of it was all the people that do work together. And yeah, we don't always agree, but a lot of times we do really see what the mission's about.
Well, you said you heard Wildenstein. What did you think hearing a program that someone was talking about being openly gay?
It was pretty
25
incredible.
Years ago.
It was pretty incredible because I only remember once before that, one of the FM stations in New York that they actually had a segment on gays, and the only song they knew was Lola. and it was, you know, that was very, you know, I guess BAI had some stuff, but I didn't really know about it. And I was telling you this earlier, back in the sort of the 60s when the revolution was sort of happening about young people being against the war and being against some of the ways, you know, the racism and all this, that Time and Newsweek would sometimes, you know, have pictures in there of somewhat naked people from like the musical Hair or something. Well, the high school I went to, the secretary used to actually cut out the pictures, you know, but I go home and we had those same magazines at home. So, and I also grew up in a small town, always seeing how corrupt things were by the same group of people, sort of, you know, and it wasn't open to new ideas. And in fact, we didn't really have black or Hispanic people, so the white people hated each other.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of this, like, well, the Italian Americans didn't like the Polish Americans, who didn't like the Russian Americans, and I just didn't understand that.
Yeah. Well, how out were you?
Not very much at all. Very, very little bit. And I wasn't publicly out at all until I moved here. And strangely enough, ABC, the American Broadcasting Company at that time, actually had a non-discrimination clause for gay people.
Wow.
Which was very, very much ahead of its time. And actually, Houston was a small, and back then, a company can only own 7 AM, 7 FM, and 7 TV stations across the entire country. So if you actually worked for what was called an O&O back then, it was pretty neat. And ABC at that time was the best company in radio.
Mm-hmm. So you continued working in radio for a number of years and volunteered at KPFT, eventually
and applied for jobs here at KPFT probably about 10 times. And
yeah, we both have, and they never hire us.
Right.
They know what rabble rousers we are, I guess. So you started going beyond the engineering and actually being a voice.
Well, and I never expected that, but you know, Ray used to talk a lot to Larry Bonnery. At that time, Larry was the president of the caucus, and Ray was very much involved in the caucus. And then Larry not only did the caucus, but he also did Pride. And Ray was doing Pride before that. So there was three things. There was Pride, the caucus, and KPFT. And at one point, Mike Meesch came back to town, and he started getting involved in the radio show. And Ray basically said, from the original thing of him being so guarded on anybody getting on because it was, you know, we didn't have the internet back there, but this was the one form of mass media that we had beyond the news. You know, we had our newspapers and stuff like this, but this was the mass media where people can listen all over the community because all you needed was a radio. So Ray basically said, I've got other things to do, so he basically gave the radio show to me and Mike Meesch.
Well, that's, you know, you recruit someone and you train them and then you get out of their way. Yeah, that's we need to be better about doing that in our activist community. So a lot of this went hand in hand from going to working, volunteering at the radio station. Your interest in politics drew you to the Houston Gay Political Caucus, which is now the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. And you've done a lot of work there. And then the work with Pride, for people who may not remember, Pride was an ad hoc committee that kind of reformed every year from year to year. And some of the same people would come and some new people. And sometimes we got right up to the month of June and we really didn't know what the heck we were doing. But you took some of the things that were developed during those years and became one of the founders of the Pride Houston Committee.
Yes, the Pride Committee of Houston, which is now known as Pride Houston. Back in the early 90s, we realized that we needed to do this year-round to build the committees and to raise the money and to make it. And this is really interesting. Somewhere back then, I remember having dinner with Ray and talking about the parade and stuff. And Ray turned to me and he said, 76 trombones. And I says, Ray, what the hell are you talking about?
And
Ray said, well, you know, just like in the movie The Music Man, those kids couldn't play a single note, but all the parents thought they were fabulous. Well, in many ways, that was our parade. We all thought it was fabulous, but in many ways, it wasn't. It was the same. You know, we didn't start on time. We didn't do all this. Well, somewhere along the line in 1995, we realized we had to, you know, look at it and decide what we're going to do. And we basically came up, do we move it to the spring? Do we move it to the fall? Do we keep it where it is? Or do we do something completely crazy and do a night parade? And Lee Harrington and Rainbow the Clown and Brandon Wolf were the three people that basically we started to talk about it, and then we went to a more open discussion and had a vote, and it pretty much came down to one vote. And it was interesting because, you know, as much as I love Lee Harrington, he's the type of person that will call you at midnight and leave a 5-minute message saying, you ought to do this, you ought to do this, you ought to do this. So you'd call him back at 7 in the morning because he'd be sleeping. But when we kept saying, well, we can't do a night parade because of this or this, Lee came up with the answers. He helped us get insurance. He helped us do this. So in 97, we did the first nighttime parade. And then 2 years later, because of Lee, he always knew we had to have some type of signature device. He had the plans for that disco ball, the mirror ball, you know, since day one. But until we had a sponsor to actually, you know, and it was really, what's really been interesting about working in this community is there's all types of people in the community, and all different types of people have ways to contribute. And in some way, Lee was, and Ray Rainbow the Clown were sort of like these barking dogs on the side.
Right.
And Lee would like go out and try to talk to this person or that person, and finally he sort of got a nip on Mattress Mac. And that year he gave the money for us to do the disco. And once Mattress Mac started talking, Lee says, okay, this is yours. You know, I'm not officially with Pride. You take it from here. So I think that's the whole thing about how we try to build community. And it's just like the radio show. I mean, you've taken over doing the scheduling, which has just, you know, been a load off of me. And you do a great, I don't always agree with your doing, but you do it, you know, you do.
I get it done.
You get it done, exactly. And
shouldn't my name be appearing as producer or co-producer?
Whatever you want to call you. Well, you're already.
Well, you know what I am. The Grandiva, the
Well, and then, or like J.D. I mean, J.D., you know, has the largest queer music collection in the world, and aren't we lucky to have him part of the show? Or Glenn, running the board. I mean, I almost forgot how to do it because Glenn does such a great job.
And then, of course, we opened it up for other people to join us, and people like Greg Chapman do segments, and Jeff Reed comes in and does some. David Elliott from Washington, Jones still is a part of the show, and Jennifer Renee, And we still, if someone has something they want to contribute,
Jennifer's
make a place for them.
In Austin today, doing a committee report on insurance for
the non-discrimination in insurance, and she said she was going to try to get back in time to, you know, maybe say a few words about what went on in Austin, but You left Pride and became the director of operations for Houston Equal Rights Alliance.
Let's back up a little bit. For many years, I was, you know, the chair of the board, or, you know, in some aspect. Originally, the only thing I wanted to do for Pride was doing publicity. Because at one time it was even called the Hyde Committee.
Yeah.
And I got to do that, and then one year
Director of Propaganda.
I said to Ray, when Ray was in charge, I said, you know, we're one of the few communities that doesn't do a published booklet. And he says, well, go do it. I says, well, I don't know the first thing about doing it. He says, well, talk to this person or talk to the, and we got it. So in 87 we started a yearly Pride book. And then when after a while, I did my work in corporate America. I worked for Metro Traffic for a number of years, not the bus company, but the the people who do traffic reports on radio stations, and traveled around the country. I approached Pride and said, you know, it would be great. And they're all pretty much sold on this. It was a matter of raising the money. That if we had a full-time person here to be able to, you know, beyond the volunteer hours, be able to keep, you know, keep the office open and do, you know, do a bunch of things. And so Pride has grown a lot right now. They have 2 full-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
But last year it just became time that it was time for me to move on. And, there's a lot of great things that are still happening at Pride. And, of course, there's this big thing about moving the parade down. Town and moving the time of the year.
Or not,
right? And that's up to the community. Hopefully it's going to be up to the community to make that decision. But as I got involved in the caucus, and the caucus is a great organization, but HERA, the Houston Equal Rights Alliance, and I sat down and first talked to April Ayers and then Tammy and said, you know, we have, and they talked to me. I mean, we've been working on this project for a couple years, that one of the key elements of the politics is the database. And the database is something that Don Rockaby started back in the 70s, which was just like way ahead of the of anybody could envision back there, before you had personal computers, before you could buy...
Before you could just write in plain English.
Right,
you had,
exactly.
You have all kinds of special computer program languages.
Right, and before, you know, as much as we all hate Access is, you know, is a database that you can use now. So Don, unfortunately, left us. He passed away, and the database for Mike Stubblefield worked on it, and you know, there's some really good people that worked on it, but it sort of got dumped into my lap. Of course, I also had this, you know, I also sort of worked with another person who we started a separate list with 50 people and kept adding on it, and I kept saying, well, we've got these, let's bring the two of them together. And there's times we broke them apart, but then we brought them back together. So one of the key elements is having the database of voter identification, and what HERA brought, and before that it was actually Equality Knox, and Tammy, and maybe Tammy should talk about it, was the knocking on the doors.
So you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, HERA started, our predecessor project was Equality Knox. We ran that in 2004. I had a wonderful opportunity to run that project, and we identified a little over 9,000 voters that year, simply asking them the question, a couple of questions. One is, you know, what do you think about a constitutional amendment to deny gay and lesbian couple couples the right to marry? And then, you know, depending on their answer, what do you think about giving gay and lesbian couples the right to marry? So it was a great opportunity, and as a result of that project and recognizing that, you know, it doesn't need to be a project, it needs to be a year-long effort that we're engaged in and investing in year after year, the Houston Equal Rights Alliance was born. We launched it in 2005.
And it's a way of knowing who your base is and
exactly.
being able to get the base out to vote or for other projects and needs that we might have. You have an office?
We do. We're at 1915 Commonwealth, and I'm very, very glad to be in that office, and I have a lot of volunteer opportunities and a lot of volunteers that come and see us on a daily basis.
And then you have regular volunteer sessions if people want to help input information or help with a mailing.
Yes, we do it on Wednesdays, except for the first Wednesday, from 6 to 9 p.m., and Saturdays from 10 to 4. And sometimes it goes on longer than that, but that's the times that we will be there. People can just drop in. We're also looking for some people who have some, you know, professional background experience. But, you know, it's interesting because, and I'll give you a couple examples. I mean, there are times that people come in and said, you know, I'd really like to do this, but I don't know the first thing. I mean, the example is sort of the Pride book, how I didn't know the first thing. But, I mean, for example, we used to have somebody, when I was at Pride, we had somebody who, we used to always have this problem of filming the parade. But then we found somebody who did it, and unfortunately he passed away, and then Troy came along, and he was really interesting in learning how to do this, and he did it for a number of years. So different people had some different projects and wanted to continue with it.
I always say that I know everything that I know from being a mom and being a volunteer, and certainly the learn by doing, realizing that you can do things that you never before even thought you could do or would do. And I was co-chair of Pride 2 years in a row. That was back when we just had Pride Week, and now we have a whole month, and not just the parade, but dozens of activities, different organizations doing things during the month of Pride. In June.
On the other hand, some people just want to sort of like come in and just do sort of mindless work because they're, you know, they worked real hard that day, and you can do that with, you know, sitting in front of a computer or doing a mail out.
Mm-hmm. And they're fun too because we
gossip.
You want to hear the good dish come to the mail outs. So in your life, Jack, what has been a high point?
I think the night parade has probably been one of the neatest things that we did because it sort of rekindled the parade from being ordinary to being something special. And, you know, I do have to credit, there's been many, many people who worked in Pride who are no longer with us, but, you know, Nick Bryans came in during a time when we didn't know the first thing about raising money, and he really helped bring Pride to a whole nother level. But we had that vehicle of the night parade, and, the first year we did it, and it started getting dark out, and the floats started lighting up. I was lighting up, I was crying, because it was just so, and even some, I mean, Mike Stubblefield was so pissed at me for something, I don't remember what it was, but he came to me and says, this is a great idea. And that was neat. I mean, over the years, what has also been really great is to see that we've made progress, that we've gotten people involved, that we've started something new. The commitment that Hera has made I wanted to subtitle this event on Thursday to something else, basically 25 years of people off.
Taking people off.
Because sometimes we have argued about, you know, commitments and doing things. And, you know, this was a community that was so much in the closet that people didn't want that advancement because they were happy being safe in their closet. So, sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes here at KPFT that the word professionalism is a bad word. because singing to the choir doesn't always work. You got to go beyond that. I've been very lucky to know people like Ray Hill. I disagree with Marion Coleman, but she's been there. you, of course.
Who you always agree with. No.
Anise Parker, Sue Lovell, and some of the people that have been in, you know, Troy, who's worked incredibly hard.
Troy Christensen.
Christensen and Pride. And I know I'm forgetting a lot of
Ed
people.
Barnes.
And Ed Barnes, my crazy friend Ed Barnes, and Don Muma. And then more recently, the caucus has really sort of gotten their act together with Maria Gonzalez and Jennifer Poole and the entire board, and then Hera, between April Ayres and Tammy Wallace, who just are, you know, it's like we're moving forward. And yes, it's going to be tough, but, you know, we've got to do this. And we challenge each other. I mean, you have to challenge each other. And we sometimes fall down on these challenges, but we get back up and we move forward.
I think most of the time we rise to the occasion. And one of the things that you've taken part in is the future conferences.
And I really haven't done much on the future conference. I mean, it's been mostly Ray Hill and Phyllis
Fry.
Phyllis Fry, another hero in this community, that, and Phyllis is, you know, basically the founder of the transgendered community in Houston and nationally. Mm-hmm. That we've worked together, we've argued, but we've worked together. And the Futures Conference is something that, you know, and these organizations have to do that. You have to stop every once in a while, even though you're always so busy putting out fires, is saying, okay, where are we going to be a year from now, 5 years from now? And I give credit for Pride doing that. Mm-hmm. We're not really sure about moving the parade downtown, some of us, but you've got to sort of take a look at that, because when you did the night parade, not everybody was for it. Some of the bar owners were very much mm-hmm. against it, but then it turned out to be the right thing. And, you know, Pride brings together about 100 to 200,000 people every year. Now we need to capitalize on that. I mean, what drives me crazy is that, you know, look at who we got in the White House, look at who we got in Austin as the ruling party, and people aren't members of civil rights organizations. We don't vote as much as we should in the percentages that we should in this community. How do you expect our civil rights organization to function, to move, whether, you know, if you don't get involved and you don't become members of it? And if it's not one of our local organizations, there's national organizations, or there's the NAACP. You know, there are so many organizations that need your help. Either financially or volunteer-wise, or both.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you've done is in 1993, you took part in some of the broadcasting of the March on Washington in April of 1993. What was that like?
Well, it was sort of exciting, although I really didn't do that much for it. And, of course, you were running the march.
yeah, along with dozens of other
right.
people.
Right, but it was sort of interesting. And a couple years ago, we actually did a national broadcast on Pride Day, which is the day after for us, and we taught, you know, we were, because of Pacifica, we were able to do it. And the first broadcast that
we used to do remotes from
the
parade. We would do color commentary.
Well, the first time that Pacifica did the broadcast of the March on Washington in 87, they didn't quite have the technology set up, so they used to record it on tape, have somebody bicycle it over to NPR to uplink it on the satellite like an hour later. I mean, you know, we've come a long way from those days. But, you know, and Pacifica has been part of Pride all over the country and the GLBT movement, because This Way Out is not done by Pacifica, but Pacifica has a strong element in that.
Mm-hmm. And that is internationally syndicated, can be heard on the Internet, just as KPFT can be heard on the Internet, or our archive shows can be listened to for 60 days and downloaded, and you can save them forever and play them back many times, because so many of our shows are so excellent. I'm sure people want to do that. Is there anything that you haven't done yet, Jack, that you'd really like to do?
Well, there's lots of things that need to be done.
Want to do.
We need
Jack Belinsky.
We need to set a platform for the next generation of continuing on the struggle. And just like the conference call that happened today at NGLTF, is that a lot of people that are growing up today don't know what we went through and know that how easily we could lose it. That AIDS education or sex education is such a dirty word, and that the only answer from the right wing is abstinence, which is not reality. that schools aren't able to have straight gay alliances, or that I just saw the movie Jesus Camp, which is just really scary about how they're recruiting the young kids and just indoctrinating them to the fundamentalist right wing. I mean, we can't, Germany had this incredibly progressive GLBT community before World War II, and it was totally wiped away. You know, that could happen again. That could happen again.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's kind of what keeps you going.
Yes, I mean, we hope that in 2 years we're going to be working to get Anise elected as mayor, and that's really important, to get GLBT and progressive people elected to office, to get people involved in the community, because, you know, Houston is so spread out that we don't always see community, and we don't have a weekly newspaper. Luckily, we've got these shows on KPFT.
Yeah, I think it's called the Montrose Gem. I think they're trying to be a weekly newspaper.
They're trying.
Yeah,
still got a lot.
But yeah, we lost the Houston Voice, and of course we have excellent work from Outsport Magazine.
Yes, but it's not a newspaper.
No, I think one of the big things though is because of the presence on the internet, and there's so many ways to find out information, and a lot of times GLBT stuff is now getting reported in mainstream media.
Yeah, but you know, and that's actually another challenge, is the fact that some of the media is so bad. I mean, they focus so much on Anna Nicole, or in the Chronicle the past couple of days, whether Ken Lay's desk is getting sold. But what's the important things? I mean, I love NPR, but when you listen to the local news on KUHF, it's a lot of rah-rah Chamber of Commerce type stories. And you know, they have a Washington correspondent. Why don't they have a City Hall correspondent? Mm-hmm. I mean, and KPFT's trying to do what they can on a limited budget of having a real news department, and they've got to give them credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything I didn't ask you about that you want to say, and then I'm going to let Tammy tell us more about the details for Thursday so we can have a good turnout there?
Well, this is unlike me to have, you know, this event is entitled Celebrating Jack Walensky, but really it's going to be celebrating the community. And, of course, I'll challenge some people to, how do we celebrate the community? How do we get involved? That's really what it's about. It's about everybody who in the past 25 years who's been involved or is new to Houston, about where we've come from, where we are, and where we would like to go.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jack Walensky, for being our guest on Queer Voices. And Tammy, the details of the celebration?
Well, can I just say first, I cannot tell you what an honor and a privilege it is to work with Jack Walensky. It has been, I've known Jack since 2004. My partner Beth has worked with him at Pride in previous years, and I learned something from him. And when, you know, constantly learn something from him.
He's always willing to share his knowledge
is.
And to teach people things
and one
they
of
need
the,
to know.
One of the most modest people I know. So not only do we need to celebrate all of his years of activism, 25 years on Thursday night, but, you know, I hope everyone recognizes the sacrifices that Jack has made over the past 25 years, because the reality is he could have been in a corporate job making a lot more money, you know, have probably, you know, a much better lifestyle financially, but he does what he's passionate about, and that is, you know, political work, working with the community, and he cares passionately about GLBT civil rights. And when the opportunity came for Hera to hire him, we were already in high gear, but we kicked it up about five notches, and I have to give April Ayers a lot of credit, our vice president, for, you know, helping to make that happen. So, and we're just ecstatic to have him as part of our staff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's not just part of our staff. He is, you know, working on behalf of our entire community, and I just want to thank him for that. So,
all right. So other folks can come and thank
absolutely.
Him. Absolutely. Shake the hand of the man.
So come on out Thursday night, March 29th, 6:30. We're going to get started over at South Beach. We're going to go from 6:30 to 9:30, and we've got three wonderful speakers. Controller Anise Parker will be with us and has known Jack for years. I won't say how many. She knew him when he had hair, I think. So, you know, it's been a while. Council Member Sue Love will be with us, and as we said in our email blast, activist extraordinaire Ray Hill will be with us, of course, one of Jack's longtime friends and fellow activists. And it's going to be a great program. We want everybody just to come out and have fun.
We're going to have some music from the Pride Band.
We are. Random Outburst.
Yeah.
Jazz Ensemble is going to be helping us out there. And
yeah. I heard they were playing at a club in Galveston this weekend to kind of warm up.
Good.
Ready for Thursday.
They stepped right up when we were looking for, you know, program. And they said, let us help out. And Don Carlos, generous, generous caterers in our community have stepped up, going to generously donate the food. We've got some wonderful business sponsors. Tony Carroll is helping us out, and IWantMyRebate.com. So Tyree Counts.
So people can go to the Hera website and order their tickets.
So can go to the Hera website. They're $25 a piece, the tickets.
More if you like.
Or more, definitely. We have Jack's Pack sponsorships for individuals, nonprofits at $100 and business sponsorships at $500. And we have on our website the ability to pay with credit card or PayPal. And tickets are also available at our office at 1915 Commonwealth. Jack's there most days, and we'll be glad to, you know, take the money and give you the tickets. And you pay online. Tickets will be left at Will Call, and we'll take care of that. And we just want everybody to come out and have a good time. And I also wanted to mention, too, on our HERA blog, which you can reach via our website at www.houstonera.org, we have a post there where people can post their thoughts up for Jack. Just, you know, their good wishes, just wishing him a great, you know, just a great night. So, you know, we want everybody to sign on and just give him a few words of applause and thanks. And
so that website is HoustonERA.org.
That's it.
Okay. Well, that kind of wraps it up for the Jack Valinsky Show on KPFT for tonight. And we're going to play another piece of music that is one of Jack's favorites.
Illegal wars, wiretaps, torture, deceit, fraud, demand impeachment. Come to the impeachment forum 6 p.m. Monday, April 9th, 2007 at Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, 2025 West 11th Street. Join us for a night of edification and action. Featured speakers include Cindy Sheehan, Bob Jensen, Deborah Sweet, Lon Burnham, Ada Edwards, Diane Wilson, Sissy Farenthold. No one will be turned away due to lack of funds. Refreshments will be provided. Visit www.paa-tx.org for more information. This is KPFT Houston.
And this is KPFT Houston. We thank you for being with us and a little bit of getting to know Jack Valinsky better after 25 years of taking part in KPFT and the other things he does in the community. Again, that fundraiser for the Houston Equal Rights Alliance and in honor of Mr. Valinsky will be Thursday at South Beach starting at 6:30. And you can go to HoustonERA.org to find out more information. Next week on the show, we'll have David Elliott from Washington, D.C. with his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. And I imagine he has some pretty juicy stuff with all that's been going on. It's time for the Jungle Party, and Brian Helvinka will join us to tell us what is planned for this year. And we'll... God, everybody's making hand signals at me. I can't talk. Also, J.D. Doyle will talk with lead artist Dead Lee about gay hip-hop. The Homo Revolution Tour hits Houston on April 6th, and we'll have some other stuff. And now we're going to the rest of the show.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way. This could happen to you.
Save the
men
in dangerous times.
Doctors, lawyers, housewives too.
Save the men.
Help your lovers, help your friends. Now's the time to lend a hand. Safe living in dangerous times. Safe living in dangerous times. Safe living in desperate times.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this month's show will visit several acts spanning the 70s and 80s. They will include bands from San Francisco, Massachusetts, and Canada, and I'll finish up
with an interview with one of my favorite recent artists, Levi Kreis. The song that started the show, of course, was referring to AIDS and was called Safe Living in Dangerous Times. It was by the group Automatic Pilot and was one of the main songs in a musical mounted by San Francisco's Theater Rhinoceros called The AIDS Show in September of 1984. But the group Automatic Pilot goes back a few years earlier, to 1980. In that year, the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus was at a retreat, and two of its members, Carl Brown and Matthew McQueen, wrote an original punk rock parody song for a skit. It went over so well that others quickly joined to form a group, sort of an offshoot of the chorus. For a name, they turned to a quote from the testimony of a psychiatrist for Dan White's defense in his trial for killing George Moscone and Harvey Milk. He sort of went on Automatic Pilot. For the next few years, the group did many performances around the city, and they were billed as San Francisco's satiric, erotic, jazz wave ensemble. Along the way, one of their members, Tony Kremidis, became their producer, and they were working towards professionally recording an album when he died. This was 1985, and the momentum was lost. Fortunately, their material was not lost, though it took 20 years to resurface. 2 years ago, founding member Carl Brown produced the release of two albums of their songs, with the first appropriately called Automatic Pilot, Back from the Dead. From it is the song, Are You in Love?
What if you could never have it? What would you do? Would you suffer? Would you turn blue? Would you know it never happened?
From 1982, Automatic Pilot and Are You in Love? I want to mention that Carl Brown has set up a wonderful website honoring the group, one of the best that I've seen in the way he's documented the history and music details, complete with song clips from almost all of their material and posters for their concerts. That's at www.automaticpilot.org. Up next is another San Francisco act, an all-women's jazz band called Alive. Lead singer Rhiannon met Carolyn Brandy and Suzanne Vicenza in 1976 at a jazz workshop, and as Rhiannon described it, the three of us fell in musical love. They were joined by Janet Small and Barbara Borden, and the act was complete, and that lineup stayed the same through their 10-year history. Though they were a jazz band and did not perform only women's lyrics, they were nonetheless very popular at women's music festivals. The group Alive released three albums together, the self-titled Alive from 1979, Call It Jazz in 1981, and City Life in 1984. And a greatest hits release came out a few years ago, named Always Alive. From their third album, I want to share with you a track called What Is Life?
The distance is far, the rest of you. No one knows exactly what to do. How you live it.
By the group Alive, that was What Is Life? I've got another women's band to bring you. The group was founded in 1972 by Beth Courant and was called Lilith. Lead vocals were done by Lou Crimmins and Janice Warner, and unfortunately, they only released one album called Boston Ride in 1978. I'm pleased to share with you from that album the title track, Boston Ride.
Boston Ride.
Boston ride.
It's always a treat for me to interview one of our pioneers, and I was able to track down the founder of Lilith, Beth Courant, for a special interview. Of course, the first thing I asked her was how the band Lilith got started.
Well, Lilith started in around 1972. I had started looking for women to play with in 1971 because the only group, or the only people that were playing, were it was folk music for women. You know, Joan Baez, which is fine, but I wanted more of the pop. And I would try to get involved with playing with men, and invariably they would leave to go on to play with other men and wouldn't take playing with a woman seriously. So I saw the Deadly Nightshade, which was a trio here in Western Mass, and it just kind of blew me away. I said, I knew women could do this. So I started looking for other women to do it, and it was hard to find people that were as serious as I was, and also, you know, not to be hung up on by some, you know, when I was, someone would call, I'd put an ad in the paper, and they'd say, I'd say, it's an all-woman stand, and they'd say, oh, well, never mind, I'm not interested, you know? So that's how that happened.
So the Deadly Nightshade was one of your inspirations?
It was. I had been thinking it was possible before that, and when I saw them, I was on a date, and I saw them playing in a restaurant in Amherst, and they were just so inspiring, yes. I could give them a lot of credit.
They didn't release anything until like 75, 76. I didn't know they were around that much earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes a little while.
Yeah. And was Fanny around that you saw?
No, I didn't run into anyone from Fanny. They weren't known in the women's community so much. And they were on a whole other coast. Now I have a connection with June Millington, who's living right near me, but they were kind of going in a different direction. And I met her around 1978. She had come to Boston for something, but I think at that time Lilith was, as far as I know, more popular, really.
How about the New Haven Women's Liberation Band?
Right. They were around. We went out there at some point when we were just, there were just a few of us in the band, I think, to jam with them or something. And they changed members often. But I don't know. They were more in Connecticut. I don't know. We were kind of on a little bit different wavelength. But they were around.
Did you consider or conceive Lilith as a feminist band or a lesbian band or what?
Yeah, that was a big issue. I just thought that I wanted women to play great music, and I was driven by the music, and also this, I'm really a big feminist from the 70s, and, you know, kind of a natural feminist. And there was a kind of an interesting divide in the, you know, there were factions, because there was Olivia Records on the West Coast, but it was music that didn't interest me. The music didn't catch me. It was more folky, and I was really into the whole rhythm, the whole band thing. And also, you know, I wanted the music to move people. So basically, I feel we got some flack from that. People boycotted some of our gigs, the Separatists, because we played music that was written by men. You know, we played cover tunes. But actually, we were a huge feminist statement, and that was part of it. It was like, you get up there and you can do it. You, any women can do this. And people were just blown away by it, not just lesbians, but all women and, you know, straight people as well.
What was the makeup of the band as far as lesbian, straight?
You know, that's interesting. We were all lesbians. No one straight ever came into the band. And I don't think we put that out or we said that. I think there was a straight woman who tried out at one point, and she just didn't fit in musically.
Just happened that way.
I don't know that we did anything that consciously, but you knew. I mean, we were fighting the battle, you know, to be able to do this. And even if we didn't get along, you knew we'd bond together when we were getting up to do a performance or something like that, because we had a fight to get into clubs. We had to, you know, people were always saying you're good for girls in the beginning and things like that. So we had a bigger battle to fight, but I don't know why that was the personality of the band.
What kind of gigs did you mostly perform?
Well, in the beginning, thank God for the gay bars and benefits. We did many, many of those in colleges, Mount Holyoke, Wheaton College, East Coast colleges. An earlier gig would have been the first Boston Gay Pride in the mid-70s, and the Long Island Women's Music Festival, and eventually in the late, in 78, we played the National Now Convention in Washington, D.C. You know, I guess you had to be chosen to play, and we were really popular at that time, and that was great.
How did you pick the name for the band?
Well, when we were just starting, it was just three of us. Two of the women had been in a shelter. They were like street kids from Springfield. They were living in the street in Springfield, basically. They had left their home or something. We were just 20. And a house, a lesbian house, took them in, and they called the house Lilith or something like that. I didn't know this, but I remember the meeting where we looked it up in the Bible, and it was a woman that was radical and feminist, and it worked for us. And, you know, we all often thought that maybe it cursed us, even. I was reading some of these old articles, because we had such a hard time getting ahead, and I just think we were ahead of our time, basically.
How would you hope people remember the band?
I would like people to, first of all, to know that we broke ground, and we're not the only ones that did, of course. You've mentioned some of the other groups that did the same thing. That we were not just women, but we were really good at what we did. And it wasn't just a band. It was a place where people could come, and it was a gathering place. Like, almost like we grew up together. If you mention Lilith to anyone who was around at the time, they'll say, oh my God, what days those were. Because you could gather at a Lilith event and just feel so good. It was so powerful. It was really empowering for lesbians. Just a great place to be. I think just for people to remember their foremothers, you know, their forefounders in this area. That's why I think the work that you're doing on this, on your radio show is so important.
Thank you. I'd like to ask that question a little differently. What do you think the role of the band Lilith is in lesbian history?
I think it's huge. I think it was the most popular women's band there was. We had the largest following, very charismatic, you know, obviously pioneers. We broke a lot of ground. We had to be very tough. And we fought for, you know, just what we were. It was natural for us to do that. I just think that we were the groundbreaking women's band. I really do.
Did you also perform at the women's music festivals?
You know, we didn't. That's interesting because when they first started it, you know, we didn't fit in because we were a rock band. It was very folky. And it was also, they wanted to hear you sing Lesbian Lesbian. They didn't want to just hear you be great and be a lesbian statement in and of yourself, because that's what you felt like when you were, when you saw us. It wasn't, you know, I think it's almost like you're on different parts of the continent, being in the middle of the country. And actually, at the end, we were going to go to the Music Michigan Women's Festival, but we broke up before that ended up happening.
How did the record come about?
Yeah, you know, everything is from the grounds up. We managed ourselves and booked ourselves, but there was this woman, Anna Marie Taylor, who had just immigrated, I think, from Italy or something, or she hadn't been here that long. And she heard us and knew that there was something magical, and she had inherited some money and decided to invest it in an album for us, which was incredibly generous of her. People didn't make albums so much, you know. It wasn't like we had a little record company or... So it was, everything was independent, which is why the album doesn't do the band justice, really. But so we found a female engineer, Karen Kane, actually, and she was doing her first album. It was... She had recorded, or her first band, I think. It was the first time she recorded a band, so everything was new. She backed the album, and then there was some discussion about whether to start selling it through the lesbian venues, and there was some struggling within the band about whether they wanted to go totally that way. Of course, I felt strongly that we should, because of the gay and lesbian movement.
And the networking.
That's right. We made it, you know, because they brought us up when we needed it. You know what I mean?
Let's get back to the band. How long did the band last?
We lasted till the end of 1978.
Gee, the album came out and that was it.
Yeah, the album came out. You know, we were getting, I think, it's just, we burned ourselves out. You know, sometimes we did six gigs a night, six sets a night. And since we were breaking ground, it wasn't just like, and we kept wondering, why aren't we getting picked up? We thought if only we were as good as possible. That was the secret, you know. And then we were really good, accepted by straight audiences and everyone alike. But we wanted to do it our own way. We didn't want to wear miniskirts. We didn't want to sell out. They wanted us to wear little dresses and uniforms. And, you know, basically the first women band to break through was the Go-Go's, and we weren't the Go-Go's. So I think that was part of it, you know, when you're in the beginning and we pushed it. And so at the end, Bonnie Raitt even came to see us and said she hadn't been blown away by a band in a long time. And she booked us to warm her up, but it just, I think we were just through. We just didn't get the break we needed.
The album contained three cover songs, but the rest of the material was all written by group members.
I don't think we even knew that you should play original material. And I do think that this was a shortcoming, but I don't, there was never any conscious talk about you would do anything but be this dance band and play at clubs and play cover tunes. And it sounds like nothing nowadays, but then it was kind of a big deal. Yeah, and then at the end we started writing, and that had just begun, that we started writing. And actually I was amazed that I could write, or that we could write. So that's why there were so few originals on the album. In fact, we hardly even played them.
Was there a particular song that was a big crowd pleaser?
Yeah. Basically, we always opened with Pick Up the Pieces, so that was a big hit. And because it was very powerful to hear a group of women play that.
not your average lesbian band. That was a little of Pick Up the Pieces by the band Lilith. Do you have any closing comments about the place of Lilith in history?
Well, I just am so amazed now that I see all these magazine covers with girls on the magazine with guitars, and it's so cool. And it's just amazing to me that that could even happen in my lifetime, because it was laughed at when I was trying to do it in the early 70s. It was not a normal thing for people to do. And you know, when I started seeing people become famous like Sheryl Crow and all that, and I said, yeah, we had something to do with that. You know, that's what I think is important for people to know, that things just don't come out of the air, that, you know, there are women before them or men before them that have pioneered, led the way.
Very nice. And what is Beth Courant doing these days? Well, she currently is co-hosting a radio program called Independent Muse on Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Massachusetts. And here's another woman's band I'd like to share with you. They were from Canada. Named after an Incan moon goddess, they were called Mama Kia II and were founded by Lorraine Segato, who did the lead vocals. They released just one recording, a 3-song, 12-inch vinyl EP, and the song that caught my love for blatant lyrics was this one, Angry Young Woman. Kia II. The group was started in 1977, and they effectively disbanded in 1982 when Lorraine Segato and drummer Billy Bryans formed the Parachute Club, one of the most popular Canadian bands of the 80s. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more Very Queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude.
I've been waiting a long time to take you on a ride like this. Sit back, relax, but listen up. I got something to say. Hit me.
change your stereo. Pump me till your sweetest blow. No reason I should hold this back now. It's time that I let it all hang out. Used to think that God was all about fear. Give him to, that's what I would hear. Be like this, boy, you should be ashamed. Who told you there was power in your own name?
If there was a line,
I crossed it.
You had to die.
Well, I knocked it. I know what I was called to do. But even if it don't make sense to you, come on now. You say I'm damned if I don't do it your way. Don't this, I fear I don't live in faith. It's time that I say it, sing it out loud. You shut me up, I'm gonna get in your face. There's a world outside, I give us something to say. It's time to be singing, sing it out loud. Just believe what you've already been told. It's so familiar that it feels like home.
Now the rest of this show will be devoted to what I think is a very fun interview with one of my favorite new artists, Levi Christ. And in a way, this is also an unusual interview because it's my second one with him. I've very rarely done second interviews on Queer Music Heritage. The first appeared on my January of 2006 show, and I think it was a very interesting one. I encourage you to check that out on my site. But to kind of set the stage, in the first interview, he told us about the struggles he went through being raised Southern Baptist. He was on his way to becoming a Christian artist, but that nasty old homosexuality got in the way. And he ended up spending 6 years in an ex-gay program before graduating as a full-fledged queer. He moved to L.A. and found opportunities in both singing and acting, and got involved in the play Southern Baptist Sissies, one of the creations of playwright Del Shores. And things have been both up and down. A down, which was probably a blessing, was being dropped by Atlantic Records. I consider it a blessing because if he had not been dropped, he would not have released in 2005 an album on his own called One of the Ones. I think that is an amazing album and was one of my favorites of that year. Now he's just come out with a new album, very different, and I just love it. So I couldn't resist having him back on Queer Music Heritage. Okay, I've brought you up to date, and you've already heard a little of one of the songs from the new album. The new album has a title that's a bit tongue-in-cheek. It's called The Gospel According to Levi. And I began the interview by asking him to tell me about the album.
Well, one review I've gotten already has said that the album is hook-driven and genre-bending, and I love that. But what is neat to me is that, finally, here's a project that where I've allowed myself to confront the issues presented to me by my history with the church. And hopefully, it's as much loving as it is confrontational, but certainly this album allows me to put the past to bed.
Now that you've told me that, is there an overall message you want this album to get across?
You know, I think if I want this album to accomplish anything, it would be to leave the listener with a suggestion that, you know, in a world of so many different belief systems, you know, we're so inclined to think that our way is the right way. But, you know, maybe perhaps our way is just another way, and that we need to allow for the journeys of other people and how they ever interpret that. And see it as equally as divine, I believe is important. Because at the end of the day, I don't think that we can even fulfill the greatest commandment that Jesus Christ gives us, love our neighbor as ourself, if deep within we really believe that this other person is wrong and I am right. And if you don't think or believe the way I do, you're wrong. So hopefully the album kind of suggests to make room for everyone's belief system.
Since your last album got such acclaim, did you have difficulty in deciding the musical direction of the new album? So many artists follow up an acclaimed album with a cookie-cutter version of it.
This is true. You know, I like to approach an album oftentimes more as a songwriter than as an artist who wants to stay within a confined stylistic place. As I was looking at the lyrics for this album, I wanted to avoid making it kind of masturbatory and a little, I don't want to make it too dark. And so I found myself trying to find a style that would interpret that lyric in the most upbeat, hooky, positive way And oftentimes that ended up being meaning that one song sounds more R&B and the next song sounds more rock and roll. And I just kind of let that be what it was. And I think probably from this project forward, I would imagine my next album is going to be more of a defined stylistic statement. But for me, it was about how do I translate the lyrics musically and make them work for this project, you know?
Let's get to one of the songs from the new album. Tell me about Bittersweet Salvation.
Oh, I would love to know what you think about Bittersweet Salvation.
I'm not the one being interviewed.
Well, you know, Bittersweet Salvation is probably the hardest song, I think, for people who might tentatively approach this new material, because maybe they still believe in the theology of Christianity, and they just have a healthy fear of God. You know, this is a song that flat out says, you told me that I was worthless, and what I needed was to rely on this outside source to save me so that I could end up in this place in the future, and that I would have to behave like this and do this right and this right, and I can't mess up, and all these things, this legalistic structure that I was kind of forced to move through with such pain and coming out with so many scars. It was kind of my way of denouncing, quite honestly, that the church, and not so much Christ and not so much the theology of Christianity, but to denounce the lack of love. It also doesn't reflect the fluidity of and the individuality of everyone's journey, and how it's mine is different from yours and yours is different from hers, and it's okay to accept others outside of that structure. And that to me is what spirituality is, and religion always feels like you have to be in this box in order for us to recognize you.
3, 4, 1, 2.
You told me nothing good would I find inside. You told me of redemption for such a worm as I. I threw myself upon the body of your Christ, abhorring all I was and all I felt inside. I held a standard in the saint that ever said. 3 hours of daily prayer didn't even clear my head. The book of law kept my young body trembling in its bed. Afraid to wake to find my spirit dead.
You said he would save me. What now am I needing? Am I not what he made me?
Where's the love? Where's the love? Where's the love?
Reach out to me, somebody tell me where love is hiding. I now believe that there's a truth in this bitter sweet salvation.
You've had a pretty good year. Let me recap what I see from where I sit. You're nominated for 3 Out Music Awards, you tour with Eric Hyman, your songs have been used in soap operas, and you already have a new album, which I think is terrific.
I feel blessed, JD, I do. And to top it off, I can tell you something even better. I got married 2 weeks ago.
Wow. Like civil union or?
Our domestic partnership, me and my now husband, Greg, went to City Hall in West Hollywood, and the mayor married us, and we signed a domestic partnership, which in the state of California is every bit as legal as a marriage. Brought his mother and a couple of our close friends, and we did it. So the whole holiday season has been kind of a honeymoon.
Well, since you're in a relationship, how has that affected your songwriting?
Well, it seemed like immediately after finding this relationship, the songs started pouring, you know, and of course one of them ended up on the new album, The Gospel According to Levi, a song called You Found Me, after going through 3 years of dating so many people, so many guys, that created one of the ones, because I wrote about all of them, I had moved back to L.A. from New York, and I was just kind of done with dating. I was like, I have all these series of 2 month relationships and 4 month relationships, and I just can't find what's compatible with me. And, you know, this guy was walking his dog by my apartment one afternoon, and yeah, we talked, and sure, he came by a second or third time, but I was not going to invest my energy in doing this all over again when I was just convinced it was not going to work. So he had the patience of Job with me. Or is that the patience of Moses? I don't remember. but he was, yes, all in all, he was a very patient man and just stood there in front of me and offered his friendship and his love until I got a clue and realized that everything I had been looking for was standing right in front of me and I needed to get on it. So it's really changed my life in such a positive way. You know, he really lifts me up to be a better person, and I hope that I do that for him.
Well, since Levi's partner Greg inspired the song, let's hear a little of You Found Me.
I never thought I was one of the lucky ones. Put my heart in a place that it didn't belong. Well, I guess you never find it if you never try. God knows I must have tried about a million times. And as soon as I said love,
the song Future Love is a grabber. Please tell me about it.
When I'm going to make an album that is that confrontational and spells out conflicts, that spells out the problem, I don't like when people spell out problems and they don't give a solution. And I knew that I needed a song on the album that gave a solution to the religious intolerance that is spoken of throughout this album. And a lot of the lyric of Future Love actually came to me from reading Conversations with God. Conversations with God has been a huge resource for me, coming where I have come from in the church and allowing my belief system to allow room for other people, for other people's belief system. And he talks about, you know, the human race being able to evolve, hopefully, to a place where we can allow room for others in their own interpretation of what their spiritual world is, whatever it is. And I just wanted it to be fun and be able to kind of a rally people together type of feel that says, look, it doesn't matter if we disagree. It doesn't matter if I call him God and you call him Allah. It doesn't matter if, you know, I go to church and you don't. You go to a Buddhist temple to meditate. None of that matters. What matters is love. What matters is unity. And I thought it was really important to put that on the album, knowing that the rest of the content is more about the conflict. You got to answer the conflict. You got to give people an answer, you know, at least my own personal answer anyway.
Open your eyes to the future, love. Open your eyes to the future, love. Hey! Hey, oh, 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 oh.
you're wrong. We're the two in a world of interpretations. So what's the point in me cutting you off?
There's a bigger picture, and the time is now. We need a new system if we're gonna find a common ground.
Come over here, baby.
Okay.
Show them what you got.
Move.
When I speak my mind, I do it with passion. But it's all good if your opinion's on mine. You will see there ain't no need to be threatened. Let's talk about it. Let's give it a try.
Yeah, there's a bigger picture. The time is now. We need to do this and if we're gonna find a common ground.
You've been listening to my interview with Levi Christ, and to find him on the net, you'll go to www.levichrist.com. That's LEVIKREIS.com. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Beth Courant and Levi Christ for the wonderful interviews. And, as I had expected, the interview was so good that I could not fit all of it into the radio version of this show. So my internet listeners can hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And, as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. You'll want to tune in next month for a special show on queer hip-hop music. But I've got one more question for Levi. Why did you choose to end your album with the song, It Is Well With My Soul?
It Is Well With My Soul was a choice I made, being that it was important for me for this album to have a little bit of love for the church put in there. I didn't want to just be, you know, confrontational with it. I didn't want to just talk about the problems that the church has and leave people with the impression that I am angry at the church or that I don't understand the importance of the church. The church has, in so many ways, has made me the man that I am today, and I honor that and respect that and need that still to a degree in my life. And I thought It Is Well With My Soul was a wonderful statement, because even though I believe differently than I used to, and I can't say that I adhere to the same theology that I once used to preach, but the truth of the matter is finding my own answers, finding my own interpretation for God, finding my own journey has made it so very well with my soul. And the peace that I feel now is... surpasses maybe the understanding of people outside of my belief system to say, well, I don't believe that you're a peaceful person because you're not believing the Bible and this and that. But I just wanted to say, you know, I take what the church has given me, and I want to kind of salute that, honor that by doing a song that I grew up with that's a part of the church, and also because of the words reflects my present state. It is well with my soul. I just didn't want people to think that I, at the end of the day, I was angry at the church and I was a church hater and that I didn't honor the church. So that's why I wanted to put that song on there.
way. When sorrows are like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well, it is well with my soul, it is well.
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
stuff to give the land of a foundation. Yes.
KPFT 90.1 FM, this is the World Village Cafe.
Mother Africa, we love and adore you, God bless you, and to you we stayed loyal. With your proud blood flowing through our veins, but if we die in vain, that would be a crying shame. Let's come together, no matter what race or nationality, no time to wait, let's face reality.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.